please state your full name for me?
George Edwin Royce, Jr.
And your date of birth?
December 25th, 1937.
Okay. And do you go by George, or do you have a nickname that you go by?
I normally go by G, just the single letter G.
Okay. So would you like me to call you G today?
That'll be fine.
All right. Let's just start, G, by telling me a little bit about how you came to Union County.
Well, my mother and father were born in Union County. My mother's family had come here in and settled on this piece of ground in 1868. And my father's father moved here before the turn of the century. The folks were in Klamath Falls during the Depression because there was no work in Union County, and so I was actually born in Klamath Falls, Oregon. And then when I was about 8 or 9 months old, Dad came back to Union County to take over both farms, his father's farm and my mother's parents' farm. And so that's what brought us back here from Klamath Falls.
Okay. What details, if any, were you told about your mother's family or your father's family who had lived here in the 1800s?
Well, I think that just that my mother's family had come out partway on the wagon train and everything, and had settled on this ground, and they were early pioneers. But not all of that family, it was the Wade family, and not all of that family stayed here. Part of them went on to Wallowa County in a few years, and some went to Walla Walla. They weren't totally happy here, the whole family, the whole Wade family.
Did you ever... We're talking about your mother's family living here. Can you give me more details about that?
Well, Mom's mother, my grandmother, was a Brooks. Her mother was a Wade, and Samuel Brooks, her father, would be my great-grandfather, came out and married one of the Wade women. And they said at one time he had quite a bit of ground and would actually give an acre of ground to somebody if they plowed an acre of ground, because some of the ground that was here was in the old native grass and it was very difficult to plow and everything. They had quite a time trying to keep the farm together in the first Depression, and so because it had been split up among five different children, that kind of distributes things out and makes it very difficult when the inheritance taxes and things come. So the farm had actually shrunk down to not as large as it was when Sam Brooks was farming it. And so my parents, when they came back here and started to farm, one of the things they did was put quite a bit of it back together into a unit, not nearly as big as what Sam Brooks had had at one time, but still a larger farm than it was when Mom and Dad returned here. Mm-hmm. So that was something that the folks did while they were alive. Didn't have to be too great, does it?
Nope.
I had a grandfather on my mother's side then that came along, and he married into the Brooks family, with my grandmother being a Brooks. And he'd always wanted to be a farmer and was a medical doctor from the East. And I don't think anybody around here, most people anyway, did not realize that he had a degree and was a medical doctor, because all he wanted to ever do was farm. So he never told anybody that he was a doctor.
So he never practiced? area?
Not in this area, no, no. He practiced for 2 or 3 years in Indiana after he got his degree, and then just came out west to see some relatives of his, and never went back, and never practiced medicine here. And I always, as a kid, I always found that kind of interesting, that he...
We're just talking about your grandfather, who was a medical doctor, but never practiced because he had a love for farming.
Yes, his name was Hugh Huron. And as I said, as a kid, I always found it fascinating that he'd never practiced medicine once he came out here. And none of my friends knew that he was a doctor, and people would, you know, just didn't talk about it or anything like that.
Now, did your grandparents ever talk about the trip here, the wagon ride? And
well, that would have been my great-grandparents, and I didn't know them. So it was the great-grandparents that came out. The great-grandparents and my great-great-grandparents. So I didn't know any of the great-grandparents at all.
Okay. So they hadn't passed down stories about their arrival?
No, not really. Not really. There nothing that I ever heard about that. It just that, you know,
okay.
here they came.
Can you tell me about your grandparents on the other side?
My granddad on my father's side came just before the turn of the century, and he decided to come west and go to Alaska. So he and another kid went down and got on the train, were to get on the train, and the other boy didn't show up. And my granddad said that his mother had made a big lunch for him, and so he felt compelled to go ahead and come. So out he came, and he got to Seattle, and went down to the docks, and was looking around and trying to figure out how to get on up to Alaska. And he said that the people coming back were starving and so poor and so ragged. He said they were much worse off than what he was, and so he decided not to go to Alaska. Mm-hmm. So he went out and in the Seattle area and started looking for work, and he couldn't find work and couldn't find it. It was very hard to get a good job. And somebody told him that if he could drive a team of horses, that the people out in the woods were looking for someone that could drive horses. Well, he couldn't do that, but another fellow said, well, tell them you can drive a team, and when they get you out there, they're so far out in the woods, they won't bring you back. They'll show you how, and that's what he did. And he went out and got a job in the woods up by Seattle, and he didn't like that because of the danger. So he moved down into the Walla Walla area and worked there for a little while, and then he came over into the Grand Round Valley, went to work at the box factory, and said he was looking around and there were too many people with fingers and thumbs and all of that missing. So that's when he went and he quit that, and he eventually ended up in a saloon and owned a saloon, and he was undoubtedly a saloon keeper until Prohibition put him out of business, and that put him up into the farming and ranching business out of Somerville, about 3 miles.
Where was the saloon located?
Saloon was in Somerville. He actually owned two saloons in Somerville. I remember him talking about the saloon, but I do not know for sure that Prohibition put him out of business. I assume that's what happened. He didn't talk about, you know, why he quit the saloon business, but he did talk about the saloon and all of that in Somerville. Somerville was a pretty good sized town. It was a big place at one time.
Now, were all of the residents, most of the residents anyway, were they farming at that time?
Oh, I don't know. With Somerville being as big as it is, I mean, they had to have a lot of other things going on down there. I'm sure there was plenty of farming going on, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the box factory. Was that also in Somerville?
I'm not sure whether it was in Somerville or Embler.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah. They had a brewery at one time, and there were several saloons in Somerville. I don't have the history of it, but I know it was pretty good size.
Mm-hmm. So he made a leap then from keeping the saloon to farming.
Farming and ranching. Grandpa Mike had. He always had chickens and pigs and sheep. Horses, cows, he had everything. He was he just enjoyed a little bit of everything in the farming and ranching business. I don't know that he was never a really superior farmer or anything like that. He would have been considered more of a rancher, I'm sure. Most of his ground was in pasture and livestock type of thing, but he was never a big cattleman or anything like that. He just had a little bit of everything.
What was his name?
Mike Royce. He, Dad told me one time that Grandpa Mike could always find some money in his pocket even during the worst of the Depression. And he would go to the sale and buy maybe some livestock that was on the bottom end of the sale, not the best stuff there. He'd take it home and he'd fatten it up, and they'd butcher it out, and then they'd take the wagon and the meat, and he'd go around to all the neighbors and sell fresh, freshly butchered meat.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways they made it through the Depression.
Now, the little bit of farming that they did do, was that with a horse?
Well, that would have been with horses at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever see pictures of that when you were growing up?
I don't think so.
No?
I don't think anybody had a real desire to, just show me a lot of pictures. They have very few pictures in the family from that era.
Did they talk about that lifestyle, about farming with the horses?
Well, my father talked about it a little bit because he definitely did not want to do that. And that was when he came back here from Klamath Falls, that was one of the things he insisted upon, was that they not farm with horses or he wasn't going to come back here. Because in the Klamath Falls area where he was and was working, they were mechanized down there, and he certainly did not like to come home to farm with horses.
Mm-hmm. So your father did sort of take over the farm then when he came over, or did he work alongside with your grandfather?
No, he came home and basically took over. He took over on Grandpa Mike's place the first year, and then about the second or third year he was home, he took over on my mother's family, took over their ground too, and farmed both places at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a caterpillar. My granddad and another fellow, Grandpa Mike, and another fellow had gone together to, and they bought a caterpillar, and so that's what they used then to farm with, put the horses away.
Mm-hmm. So at that time then, when he kind of took over for both places, when was he involved in more? I'm not sure what you call it, but more. You mentioned he had a lot of different animals and was doing like ranching. But when he consolidated the two, was there more ground involved?
Well, there would have been the ground of both places, and my dad never did take over the livestock. I mean, he helped out with the livestock that my granddad Mike had and things like that. But Grandpa Mike kept his hand in on the stock end of it. Dad just took over on the agricultural farming end of it. And my granddad Hugh, he never had a lot of livestock in my lifetime that I remember. He had two or three horses and some milk cows, and that was about all I remember him having. They had sheep. My granddad Hugh, this is on my mother's side, had sheep when they were younger, but that was long before I was born.
What did their crops consist of?
The crops would have been, and we're talking now in the 1940s, and the crops would have been mostly wheat and peas, pay. And I that would have been that. There might have been a little bit of grass seed early in the 40s, but grass seed did not become a big crop until the mid 1940s, and then late 40s and early 50s was when the grass seed really got going. Mm-hmm.
Where would they sell their products to? Was this locally or?
You know, that I think. Locally, there were co-ops, and then when the grass seed came in, then that went nationwide. Mm-hmm. That became a crop that went nationwide. And actually, the Austrian peas, Dad had said a time or two that the Austrian peas were the first cash crop that he could remember coming into the valley. And the Austrian pea was different than the edible pea. They used it as a nitrogen-fixing crop, and they raised the seed and shipped that out of here for other areas that wanted to raise that crop.
Mm-hmm. Would it have been shipped out by the railroad at that time?
It would have, yeah. And most everything that left here in those days would have been with rail car.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about. Kind of growing up, now that your father has taken over both places and you've moved back to this area, what was it like for you to grow up?
Well, it was just free and easy as a child because the closest neighbors and my grandparents, and they lived almost a mile away. Any other neighbor would have been a full mile away. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have any neighbors. You didn't have any... You didn't have any restrictions. Once you'd learned to swim, you could just about go anywhere you wanted around here and have a good time. And if you had a bicycle, then that was good. A horse, I never enjoyed horses too much because Grandpa Mike would always bring by one that was just a little bit wilder than what I wanted to ride. So I mean, at the time it was fun, I suppose, but I've certainly got bucked off. And
was that for his entertainment?
No, I think it was just whatever he had at the time. And he enjoyed livestock. Grandpa Mike really enjoyed livestock and riding and a good horse and all of that. And I was probably the grandson that he just couldn't figure out why I didn't enjoy those things too.
Mm-hmm.
But and I did have fun. Some with that, but not as much as I think Grandpa Mike always wanted. So he'd just come by some days and take my horse, and he'd be gone, and maybe another one would show up.
Okay. Now, did you have siblings?
I did. A sister, 9 years older, and then a little brother that was 7 years younger.
Okay. So you were right in the middle.
I was.
So tell me, your parents were involved in renting a farm. What did that involve?
Well, I think in the 40s and the 50s, as everything became mechanized, that things changed as you went from the horses to the tractors, and the crops changed a little bit. Not a lot at first, but eventually the grass seed was the crop that really came in, and Dad started into that early on, and that became basically the crop of choice because that was where there was some money to be made as things developed.
We're talking about some of the daily chores of Dad and Mom and you. So can you just continue on with your dad's work?
I think that the generation ahead of me, my mother and father and all the people that came out of the Depression, worked extremely hard to get ahead because they had lived through some very hard, struggling times. And I know that Dad said when he was in Klamath Falls, I talked to him about it once, and I asked him about how much he was getting paid and some of the working conditions down there, and he told me that he worked for the man in Klamath Falls on a potato ranch for a year before he asked him how much the man was paying him. Because all Dad cared about was he had a job, he had a roof over his head, and they had food on the table. And that was kind of the, and he got one day off, he got Christmas Day off, and so he worked 364 days a year. So that was the work ethic and the, and everything that, that came back that I grew up under, I mean, you know, underneath, that was how the family worked. And Dad worked most of the time 7 days a week, and they worked from daylight to dark, especially in the farming season, which here we farm from March to December. That's, I mean, and then winter can set in and run through the other months. But that didn't mean that Dad didn't work from December back to March, because they went into the shop and worked on equipment and got things ready to go again. So the work ethic on the farm was you just worked. Yeah, I mean, that was it. And I can remember that it was a... You never knew if you're going to take Easter off. Because my dad, if there was work to do, my dad was going to go out and do it. And not that he wasn't religious and all of that, but it was just work. The work came first. So he worked extremely hard. And my mother also was working. She was raising me, and then later my little brother came along. But during the summer, when they had harvest crews and things in, and you have to realize that we weren't as mechanized then as we are now, so there was still a lot of manual labor through harvest with the way the equipment was, and she would take hot meals out at noon because you didn't need a sandwich for your main midday meal. You had to have a hot meal in the field, and so she fed the entire crew, which would run from 15 to maybe 25 people, you know, just depending on how big that summer crew was.
So she would pack that meal and
put it in the back of it in the back of the car and drive to whatever field the men were working in. If they were close to the house, the men would come to the house. And we had a big table set up on the back porch that we would feed them there. If they were close to my grandparents' house on either side, they would go to that house and eat. But if they were over a mile away from the house, they wouldn't stop long enough to come to the house. They would expect my mother to show up with the car loaded with hot food.
Now, what would a typical meal consist of?
Oh, it would be meat, bread, and potatoes, and the salads. You know, your typical old-fashioned heavy farm meal. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be roast beef or fried chicken or what, you know, ham or something like that with mashed potatoes. I suppose almost all the time.
All homegrown?
Well, some of it was homegrown, but a lot of it they purchased too. Mm-hmm. Half and half, I would think. Yeah.
Did she do a lot of her own baking?
She did some baking and did some canning. Probably not as much as other people. My grandmother on both sides would have done more canning and baking maybe than my mother did.
What about other chores for your mom? Did she work outside of the home, or was her work all on the farm?
No, that would have all been on the farm. Mom worked before Mom and Dad got married. Mom was a school teacher and taught school, but the minute the folks got married, that came to an abrupt end, because married people, you could only have one bread earner and so that wasn't going to be that she was going to continue teaching, you know, way back.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been in the early 30s. So, and she never went back. She never went back to teaching or anything. She stayed home and raised the kids.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about some of your responsibilities as you got a little bit older.
Give me a date or an age.
Well, when were you responsible for some of the chores on the farm?
Well, seeing as how Dad was not particularly fond of livestock, and the chickens, I don't know what time the chickens went, but as I got older, the only responsibilities I had as a youngster were probably when I had to milk cows, and I did have to cook for my grandparents and milk cows. That probably didn't happen until I was 12 or 13 years old. And then I did milk a couple cows for them up until I was about 18. So that was about the only responsibilities I had with stock. Of course, there was always, you know, the same things all kids yell about, and that, you know, to take out the garbage or do something with the trash and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
During the summer, of course, Dad always had, there was always something then to do in the field. And I probably started on a tractor when I was 12. I would guess that somewhere in that age. And then once you got to that age and could do something, there was always a field or something to do something in.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall how you learned how to drive a tractor?
Well, they just stuck you on it and gave you a little lesson and turned you loose. And you have to realize this was a Caterpillar, that the wheel tractors were not really being used as a big farm equipment yet to work the ground. And so when I talked about being 12, that would have been on a Caterpillar, where you just sit on it and pull the two levers in front of you and turn it from one, go around back and forth like
mm-hmm.
that. Not the big wheel tractors like we have now.
Okay. So where did you go to school?
Went to school at Imbler. Started there right off the bat in the first grade. They didn't have kindergarten. And about halfway through the first year, they consolidated with Somerville. So here came a whole new group of young kids. Practically ruined my whole year because I was very, very shy. And it just kind of got settled into this whole thing of going to school and having other kids. My closest neighbor, you see, when I was that age, there was only one boy that was very close, and he was a mile away. So I hadn't really probably had the opportunity to play with a lot of kids like children do now. There's no way were you going to get sent off to any kind of a kindergarten or a situation like that. So here came a new group of kids out of Somerville in the first grade, and then I settled down after a while the way we went. I still have good friends that were in that group.
Mm-hmm. How many students do you suppose were in your class in the early
well,
years, first, second, third grade?
Okay, we were probably 13, 14, 15 in a class, maybe not even that much to begin with, because the teacher had two classes put together. When I was a first grader, we were with the second graders, and then the next year we were with the first graders, the class behind us, and that lasted up through about the fourth grade when we had two combined classes. And then the fifth grade was the first year that I remember being alone, and we ran about 18 or 19 kids from there on until I graduated, and we graduated 18 students out of high school.
Also graduated from Imbler then?
I did.
Okay. Were you involved in any type of activities in school?
I was involved in most activities. The sports were baseball and football and basketball, and then I was involved in FFA, and There was we had one other club, Future Business Leaders or something like that, that I was involved in it for 1 year as a senior. Can't think of any others that were outstanding.
Were you able to travel at all with the sports team?
Yeah, locally. We never were good enough to make it off to a state or anything like that. But in the FFA, we made it off to Portland a couple of years and down to Medford once in FFA activities.
So what did you do for fun when you weren't in school and playing sports?
Well, fun would be, as a kid, fun would have been fishing and just walking the hills with my good friend Jim McInnes. We covered a lot of ground over on the Pumpkin Ridge, which is off to the north, and things like that. This is all before we got a car, I'm speaking about now. Mm-hmm. This is, once we had wheels, then it was a different story. But I like to fish. I really enjoyed fishing. And like I say, once you learned how to swim, then I had free rein to go anywhere on the place I wanted. And the creek's only about, it'll be about 3/8 of a mile away. Mm-hmm. So we got to go down, I got to go down and fish all I wanted to. Got a 22 when I was probably, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old, and I could go shoot squirrels. We had a lot of ground squirrels in the fields.
We're just talking about some of the activities that you enjoyed doing, and you were telling me about hunting and shooting ground squirrels.
And I probably started hunting with my father when I was about 12. Dad did like to hunt. That was one of the few recreational things that he enjoyed, was hunting birds. He never hunted elk or deer or anything like that. He had a .22 rifle, but I don't think he ever had a bigger rifle that I remember in his life. But he did have shotguns, and he liked to trap shoot. He took me trap shooting quite a bit when I was younger, and he really enjoyed bird hunting and things. So I did a lot of bird hunting in the fall for recreation.
You said it changed a lot when you got wheels. In what way?
Well, once you had wheels, then you could travel just a little bit further away from home than the local creek.
So where would you go?
We would probably go to LeGrand, mostly.
The big city.
The big city. The big city of LeGrand. Yep. You would.
Did you have a favorite hangout spot in LeGrand?
Up and down Adams Avenue. They called it. They didn't call it cruising. That was dragging the gut.
Oh, dragging the gut.
You haven't heard the expression, dragging the gut?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, I explained it to one of my daughters one time and said, oh, yeah, we go to town and drag the gut. So she didn't remember the expression, and I found her one day using the they drag the cat, she thought I'd said. She didn't understand the gut. But a boy from out at this end of the valley, LeGrand was the bright lights, and that's the direction you go. And I suppose that the LeGrand girls were always the big temptation, because they were the unknown. You didn't know who they were or what they were, but they always seemed to have a little bit of shine in their hair, you know, and a faster step than these poor girls out here. Remember? By the way, now I have to tell you, the girls from him were always trying to date the LeGrand boys. So this was an equal opportunity situation.
Okay.
Here.
So did you have a favorite spot though, besides cruising? Did you go to movies or go?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there was always that. That was about. You'd like to go to the movies. You'd like to go, you know, out and get a hamburger and a milkshake. It was a lot different then, because you didn't have television. When I was in school, there were no television at home, and listening to the radio was not all that exciting. It was when I was a kid. You listened to the radio quite a bit more, mm-hmm. And listened to the programs.
Do you recall any of those programs?
Well, some of the, you know, would be Jack Benny and Amos and Andy. Some of those, what was the one, The Shadow Knows, whatever that one was, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, some of those programs like that. But I read a lot, too. I think that's one thing that that the kids nowadays, they play a lot of games on TV, which I would assume I'd do the same thing now, but when I was growing up, I read a lot of books, enjoyed reading. Mom had a terrible time getting me to go to sleep at night sometimes. In fact, I'd actually take a flashlight and get under the covers and then read by flashlight because she'd yell at me if she thought I was still awake upstairs.
Did you have a sense of taking over the family farm? Because you had come from a long line of farmers, did it ever occur to you that that's what you would do?
No, definitely not. I did not enjoy farming. I had a lot of allergies as a child. I couldn't even hardly go past a hay field. And hay was one of the things that the kids always worked in first off. You know, you go out and buck bales when you're a young guy. I couldn't even hardly do any of that. So because of the allergies and all the problems I'd had, I always worked the summer fall, which is just plain dirt without any weeds or anything in it. But I didn't enjoy it, didn't like it, and never, ever thought that I would farm. It was just not to be. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't that thought.
Okay. What happened after you graduated from high school?
Well, after getting out of high school, I went to Oregon State and really didn't know what I wanted to do. So I think I majored in geology and didn't find that attractive and switched off into liberal arts, still wondering what I was going to do. And stayed at Oregon State the first year, came home, worked on the farm again, then the next year decided to go to Gonzaga, which was up at Spokane, and went to Gonzaga for half a year. Started the next semester, had a problem with getting thrown out of the dormitory due to an excessive amount of alcohol within my system. And at that time at Gonzaga University, you could not be a new student, which I was as a transfer student, and not live in the dormitories. So the folks came up and we had a meeting with the president of the college, and I assured him that I would not do such a thing again. And he wanted me back in the school, but the prefix of the dormitory would not accept me back, and he had authority at that dormitory, and so there was no way I could stay in school. I have somewhere in all my belongings there's a very nice letter from the president stating that I would be welcome back the next year. But anyway, I came home, and the folks wanted me to go on to college. Dad had always dreamed of going to college himself, but it didn't work out. I mean, they didn't have the money. In fact, the things got so bad that he was down at Mount Angel going to school down there, and because there just wasn't the money, he had to come home, and he'd always dreamed of college. So he wanted me to go to Eastern Oregon because it was right here close. And I, by this time, was totally burned out on the whole situation and didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. When you're sitting on a farm and you don't want a farm and you don't know where to go, it's a difficult situation. So anyway, I entered up here at Eastern and didn't like it. Just did not do any work, and basically I would imagine I probably drew all F's. I just walked away from it, and so I was down at the Stampede, which is a rodeo at Elgin, and another fellow and I were having a sip of whiskey out on a creek bank, and we decided that the best thing to do in this world was to join the Army. And by the 30th of July that year, I was in Uncle Sam's Finest down in Fort Ord, California. And there I was in my new experience.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something. You can certainly decline, but you've mentioned alcohol use a couple of different times.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, growing up in this small rural area, do you think that contributed to your use of alcohol?
Well, I don't know that growing up in the small rural area would contribute to that any more than maybe anywhere else. When I was growing up, it was a macho thing as much as anything else, you know. But then I think it's probably hereditary, and who knows why young people, you know, would drink and get wild. And my granddad had the saloon in Somerville, and he always said, you never will you feel better than two drinks, and so there's no sense in drinking more than two drinks. Mm-hmm. And that just didn't sink into my little head for a long, long time. It was just the group I ran around with. I think a lot of times we're influenced by the people we are with at any particular time, and I notice with my kids and other people that I've been around, if you're in with a really good, solid group of people, your chances of being really solid and good are going to be better than if you're in with a bunch of no goods. I had two nephews that came and lived with us at various times, and the one nephew came, and there were four other boys or five other boys that were just outstanding citizens, and that nephew just breezed along in school while he was here. The other nephew came, same type of situation, except there were six hooligans going through Embler High School when he came to live with us, and he was just like them, and they were into drugs continually while he was here. And I think if it had been reversed, I mean, I don't think it had anything to do with the kids. I think it had to do with the people they associated with while they were here going to school.
Okay. I appreciate your answer.
Yeah.
I think something special happened after you came home from the military. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I went back to work on when I came home. I assume what you're talking about is meeting my wife.
Yes, that, I know.
Yeah. Well, okay. You know, when I came back, let me throw in some stuff about the military, because that shaped where I went and what I became, and so I'll just interject it right now.
Okay.
I hadn't been in the military a week, I don't think, when I was sitting down trying to figure out exactly how many years and days and hours I'd signed up for. I knew it was different than anything I'd ever run into before. And it really shaped my life, because I had been exposed to the military when I was in the eighth grade, and being a young hooligan, the folks had sent me off to Hill Military Academy after I was just a little too difficult to handle, and my mother had been pretty sick. She had antibiotic poisoning in the early 50s. They gave her too much antibiotics, and it really hurt her health, and so she couldn't handle this young eighth grade hooligan she had. So they sent me to Hill Military Academy in Portland, and I actually graduated from the eighth grade down at Hill Military Academy. Well, that exposed me a little bit to the military, so when I went to Oregon State, I took 1 year of ROTC. Okay, so now I've got all this background in military that kind of made let me understand a little bit about it, but I didn't know everything about it. But when I got off and into the Army, I knew how to get along in the military, because I knew of the discipline and the chain of command and how to say yes sir, no sir, and I knew how to march. So I fit in pretty well. And I went in as a military policeman and went to Fort Ord, and then I went to Fort Gordon, Georgia, and then I went to Brooklyn, New York. Now, here's a kid from Somerville, Oregon, never been, you know, out and about except when I was in the eighth grade, which when you're a kid like that, you don't really learn a lot. But anyway, so now I'm in Brooklyn, New York, and I learned about the dangers of the big city and the world. And it was interesting. Well, then I headed off to Korea for 13 months, and I was in a foreign country, and I saw things that you don't get to see in the United States. So I'm really being exposed to a lot of different things in the 3 years that I spent in the Army. But when I came home, I have told people it was a year before I was fit to be around. It was a year. I had to watch what I said when I was around my mother. Because when you're in the Army and you're gone, especially overseas, your language changes, your whole being changes. I mean, you become a totally different person than you were when you left and when you went in. And until you've been there and done that, you can't imagine the change that can come over you that you can only look back on and see. I feel sorry for the things that are going on in the military right now, because I know that some of those people, that's not the people overseas, some of those people, that's not the person they really are. It just isn't. But anyway, I went through all of that. Came back and was trying to readjust my life. And they tell you when you get out of the Army that you're going to have problems. Some people can't readjust to go back to civilian life. But I was here on the farm, and when I came home, here I am, a young, husky, you know, go get 'em. And I had decided when I was in the service that the farm life was not too bad, but I still didn't think I wanted to be a farmer. And it was just not something that I'd ever really planned on. So I came home and worked on the farm that summer, drove combine. Dad had bought a big new combine, and the equipment had changed with how the operation went and everything. And so that was all, it was all new, and things were just making a big change there. Then about, well, I guess it would be almost 2 years, year and three quarters after I got back and out of the service, I met my wife-to-be and took her out on a date. And I dated some other people in the meantime and things, but I had a lot of settling down to do before I met her, because I would have scared her to death if I'd have met her when I first got home. And so then that was another changing point in my life right then.
Was she from here?
She was living in Embler. She had gone to school in La Grande, and she graduated from La Grande High School. And she came here when she was 12. She'd moved here from Kansas. Mm-hmm. So she did not go to Embler High School. Her little sister was going to Embler, but she did not. And like I say, I was totally different than anybody that she'd probably have ever wanted to go with when I was younger. I had to make a change.
What was her name?
Valerie. Eisminger was her last name. Val. She called Val.
Eisminger?
Eisminger, E-I-S-I-M-I-N-G-E-R. Good German name.
Okay. So you married?
Yeah, after a brief courtship, I guess. Mm-hmm. When I met her, my brother lined us up, and he had met her somewhere, and you know, told her that he wanted to line her up with his brother, and he lined us up. We had a blind date on a Saturday, and then the next Saturday night I took her out again, and then we had a third date, and she had to leave then. She had a job at Crater Lake after the summer, so she headed off to Crater Lake, and I, of course, went back to work on the farm. I went down to see her about midway through the summer and told her that I would come down and pick her up and bring her home at the end of the summer. And I was just kind of checking her out, see, because that would have been the fourth date. So when I went down to get her and bring her home at the end of the summer, I proposed to her. Because I'd come home and I'd given it a lot of thought and just decided that there wasn't going to be anybody that I ever met that would be better than she was. I mean, it was just one of those things. She's very attractive. She's extremely smart. And there was enough of a spark between us that I just decided that was going to be it. So. That was at the end of that summer, and we got married the next March. Val was in school at Eastern, and she's 5 years younger than I, and she was finishing up she was in her junior year that next year, and so we waited till spring break and got married.
So that was March
16th, 1963.
Okay. So then tell me sort of what happened once you got married and settled in and were not going to be a farmer.
Well, we got married in 63, and of course she had another year of college. She was not finished yet, and so the next year she went on and finished up her schooling. I was working in the fertilizer plant in Embler. Dad had decided that we needed a plant to handle bulk fertilizer, because in the grass business you apply a lot of fertilizer, and we'd been using sacked fertilizer, which came in on railroad cars, and by the time you unload a lot of sack fertilizer off of a railroad car and onto a hand truck and hand truck it into a building and unload it and then take it out and hand truck it onto a truck and haul it out to the farm, and you pick up the sack and you put it into the fertilizer spreader and cut the paper sack open, you've handled it a lot, and it's way too much. So Dad put up a bulk plant to where you could drive in and dump it into a box, take it to the field, and put it straight into the fertilizer spreader. Mm-hmm. And so I was working there because that was not a dust that bothered my allergies as much as the dust on the farm. And the fertilizer dust didn't seem to cause any problems with me, and when I'd come back from the service, my allergies were actually worse than before I went in. The grass dust it just knocked me flat part of the time. It was really bad. And when you're in the grass seed business, and the grass is one of the biggest allergy problems, well, you know, it's kind of tough to get around. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's where I was working.
Where was this?
In Embler. The fertilizer plant was in Embler. Mm-hmm. And I'd help out on the farm a little bit. And I was still trying to decide what I was going to do. There were opportunities in the fertilizer business that I was looking at. There were things that could be done to promote fertilizer, bulk fertilizer in the valley, and then there were things outside of the valley. There were a couple of fertilizer opportunities to go sell fertilizer and work with it. But in July of 1964, with the equipment, all the combines and everything was ready to go to the field, and we hadn't started yet. Cut her off for a minute.
Okay, you're telling me about a day in 1964, I believe.
Right, in July. And the reason I remember about when it was is because I was once again down at the Elgin Stampede. Seems like a couple changes in my life happened at the Elgin Stampede. I was not drinking whiskey out on the creek bank this time, though. They called and said that, actually they announced it over the speaker system that I was wanted at the box office, and I went out, and Dad had had a heart attack. Now, Dad had a couple heart attacks earlier in his life, but this one was pretty bad, and the others had been a little milder. They didn't know if he was going to make it or not, and so the unfortunate thing about all this was, well, of course, his heart attack, but the equipment was lined up in front of the shop, ready to go to the field the next day, and it just fell upon my shoulders at that time to have to come out the next morning and okay. It with the equipment out there and ready to go, and Dad not here. I was the next morning. I had to come down and tell the men what to do because we were ready to go, and I apparently was going to be the boss at that point in time. And so I had to shift from not knowing what I was going to do for a little while into knowing exactly what I was going to do, and I was going to have to take care of the farm because Dad was up there and didn't know if he would live, die, or what. And so that was a major shift right at that time. And I came down, and I was extremely lucky. We had a good person working on the farm for Dad. And he knew what to do, and he helped guide me through that first day. And then the next day came, and I had to go back out and do it again. And your thought patterns change a lot. And this is where the military came in and helped me a lot, because I was very organized with knowing that as the top person, you had to have everybody lined out the next day exactly as to where they would be and what they would do and who would be working for them or under them or around them. And so I really appreciated what I'd learned in the military, but I was probably a snot-nosed kid out there also from the perspective of some of the older people that were working for us. So within the first week, I had told one of the men that he could no longer drink while he was on the job. And this was the man that was running the cleaning plant, because we did our own cleaning also. And so he had quit me and said, you can't talk to me that way. But that was a standard that I set, that you could not drink while you worked for me. And I held that standard myself then, from then on. Any time the rest of my farming time that I took a drink, that was the last hour I worked on that particular day, and I stuck by that, even though, you know, and I know a lot of people that don't stick by that one. They could take a drink and then they go off and keep farming. But it was a really difficult time to settle in. I was very uncomfortable with that fact, and yet it was a time of change within me, because once you start to run the organization, whether, I don't think it makes any difference what the organization is, whether it's a farm or a business or whatever, and once you start making the decisions and you like to make decisions and you like to control things, it takes on a whole new perspective. And I loved the farming from that year on. It just became something that I loved to do. It's so much different than when you're just sitting out in a field somewhere working. Now, not that that work didn't become pleasant too, because it did. I mean, I enjoyed that part of it. But the control and running of the farm became very, very enjoyable. And that all started right that time in July. Mm-hmm. But the pressure and the stress and the tension also started at that very moment that I'd never had on me. Mm-hmm. And that you learn to live with. And I'm not sure that you ever realize how much pressure and tension you're under in any job until you get away from it. Mm-hmm. So if people would have come up to me then and said, you know, oh, you're under a lot of stress, I'd have probably said, oh, you know, you can handle this. But that was a change that came into my life right then, and away I went running the farm. And I was very fortunate because Dad survived the heart attack, and he came back, and he did not come back and take over the farm. He, at that point in his life, made a shift in his life and went and started to build a new cleaning plant, because he had always cleaned his own grass seed and enjoyed that. Dad actually enjoyed cleaning seed more than he enjoyed the farming operation. Mm-hmm. He enjoyed the combining or the thrashing operations where you clean the seed and separate it from the chaff and from the straw. And so he had a cleaning operation and had since he started. And he expanded that, and we went the next year into bulk grass handling, which was another shift in the farming operation. And he went to Imler. Dad went up into Imler and got some ground and started another phase of the cleaning operation.